The Economic Development and Housing Budget Division for Wednesday, March 18th, 2009 will come to order. Senator Sparks, let's start with yours. And the quorum is present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 952. The Biobusiness Alliance is an exciting organization implementing a strategy that is exactly what Minnesota needs to be doing. The organization is at a point where they are just starting to see fruition from their work. Ongoing investment is the key as they continue their work to create, retain, and recruit companies in Minnesota. The Biobusiness Alliance has supported over 45 companies since being founded in 2005, Mr. Chair and members. They have recently completed a 20-year visioning process that is being utilized by communities across the state to grow the regional bioscience industry, including in the northeastern Minnesota, where they recently completed a bioscience strategy plan focused on renewable materials and by district through partnering with the leadership at the Hormel Institute to advance their technologies. From the Biobusiness Alliance's work, we have a plan for the state to be competitive. We need this organization to keep implementing. The investment is producing the types of results that we are seeking, a direction in a complex industry, job creation, and job retention, Mr. Chair. There are three people here that I'd like to have testify today, Mr. Chair and members. Dale Wallstrom, the CEO of the Biobusiness Alliance, Ms. Gail Dennison from the Hormel Institute, and Dave Malia from ASI. And if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, we'll begin with Mr. Wallstrom.
I'm not sure if it's okay. No, it's okay. Mr. Wallstrom, thank you, Senator Sparks. Mr. Wallstrom, say your name for the record, please.
My name is Dale Wallstrom. I'm CEO of the Biobusiness Alliance in Minnesota. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni, and the committee for hearing our bill.
Mr. Wallstrom, can you pull the microphone a little bit closer to you? Thank you.
Okay, is that better?
Yep.
Okay, I'll repeat that then. My name is Dale Wallstrom. I'm the CEO of the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. I want to thank you, Senator Tomasoni, and the committee, as well as Senator Sparks, for introducing and hearing the bill today, and for those who are testifying for coming in to help. The Biobusiness Alliance is seeking $1.1 million in each year of the biennium to support the continued creation, recruitment, retention, and expansion of biobusinesses in our state. The money will be used to implement the 20-year bioscience roadmap, which we call Destination 2025, which Senator Sparks alluded to, ongoing assessment of Minnesota's competitiveness on a national and global basis, the continued working in collaboration with industry, academia, and government to ensure long-term vitality of Minnesota's biobusiness industry, expanding the biobusiness resource network to support emerging and established companies, and identifying specific strategies and investments needed to ensure and enhance Minnesota's growth and competitive position in biotech. The Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota has a strong track record of success, as exemplified by the publication of the 20-year vision and roadmap. Another example is the Elk Run investment that's occurring in Pine Island, which we've been involved with for the last 3 years. The relocation of a medical device company from Massachusetts, the expansion of a North Carolina company here in Minnesota that is functioning in the area of renewable energy, as well as several companies from Sweden that are establishing their U.S. operation in Minnesota. And finally, the establishment of Minnesota as a site for the International Renewable Energy Technology Institute. These are just some examples. We have more if you'd like to hear them. We feel the Biobusiness Alliance is providing an extremely high return on investment to the state. As Senator Sparks mentioned, during 2007-2008, in preparation for what we call our Phase 3 of operation, which started with the release of the 20-year roadmap, we supported 45 companies. Of those 45 companies, startup organizations, as of December, they were now employing 283 people. We asked them in our questionnaire what they expected their employment to be over the next 3 years, and that number exceeded 850 people as their current projections. So there are still companies hiring, and many of them are small and startup. These companies are considering or are already located in locations throughout the state, including Worthington, Mankato, Wilmer, the Arrowhead region, the Iron Range, Rochester, as well as the Twin Cities. Other states, most notably states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, are making very large investments in biobusiness, and they are specifically targeting the Minnesota firms to relocate into their community. We as a state have many advantages over many of these other states, but those advantages need to be maintained and leveraged and organized in order to draw full value from them. We all know that we've lost jobs and companies from our from some inaction in providing that type of support over the recent years. We feel that the Biobusiness Alliance has provided some of the key services to address these issues, including such things as CEO mentoring, introduction to investors. Several of the companies I mentioned have received investment as a result of our involvement. Researchers, introduction of researchers and other key partners to appropriate people, site selection support, as well as state exposure and involvement in our statewide network, which now consists of over 2,300 organizations, companies, and institutions that are involved in have capability to help us grow and establish industry here. So that's the end of my introductory comments. I'd like to now introduce Gail Dennison from the Hormel Institute to continue the testimony.
Welcome, Ms. Dennison.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Tomasini, and thank you, Senators. Tomasini.
There's a David Tomasini in Hibbing, and he gets a lot of my phone calls. So it's
okay. All right. Well, excuse me. Anyway, thank you for.
He's been doing a pretty good job, though, because I keep getting reelected. So it's
good. Good. Well, thank you. Right. I am Gail Dennison with the Hormel Institute, University of Minnesota Mayo Clinic. We are a cancer research center located in Austin, Minnesota. We are part of the University of Minnesota. And 2 years ago, when we announced our expansion of a $23.4 million cancer research center, we became regional partners with Mayo Clinic. Mayo Clinic is known around the world, and they chose the Hormel Institute to establish their cancer research partnership with. We are amongst the top in the state, in the nation, and in the world in our area of chemo-preventive cancer research. We look for what it is in food compounds that has a cancer preventive quality, and we are looking for it forward to the future for drug development. We recently announced that we were the first in the state to acquire our own IBM BlueGene L supercomputer, and that accelerates our cancer research. I say these things about us because our growth is truly dependent on an organization such as Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. As we go forward with our growth, we need to rely on the expertise, the networking, and the leadership of Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. I want to share with you, on Friday, I was at a conference in Mankato. It was hosted by Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation and the Southwest Initiative Foundation. There were a couple hundred people there from all walks of our community, medical, agriculture, and private business, citizens from the community. All of us had a little voting device. The number one, above anything else that they voted on, that they wanted to see grow in our state and their hope for the future, was bioscience. They voted against themselves, in other words, to support what they thought was the vision of the future. The Hormel Institute is amongst, one of the leaders in the nation and in the world in our area. We know this because we're published in the top-tier scientific journals that are out there. Just this past week, our work was published in Nature, the number one research journal in the world. Dr. Dong, if any of you have ever met him, he's our executive director. We're only at the beginning of our growth. Yes, we've added 100 new jobs. We have 5 years to do that. We're already well ahead of that, and we had our grand opening in October. He has a vision of adding a couple more buildings and 300 more jobs, but we cannot do growth like that without Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. And so the state has spoken and said bioscience is their priority. We have done our part. We're expanding. But we need an organization such as BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota to be funded and to be the foundational strength behind us, because we can't do it alone. So thank you.
Ms. Dennison,
yes.
Will the Hormel Institute be developing Super Spam at any point in time here?
Just we share the name, but actually in 1942 they gave it to University of Minnesota, and so that's where our research ends. We're into cancer prevention, and Hormel does their own food things.
I had a lot of that Spam when I was a kid. What about you, Senator Metzen? Did you have Spam when you were a kid?
I'm not that old.
Not that old. Thank you.
Still selling pretty good right now.
Who's next?
Well, good afternoon, Senator Tomasoni, committee members. My name is Dave Moline. I'm a Minnesota-born, Minnesota-educated bioscience professional in the biopharmaceutical space. And it's a pleasure for me to be here with the BioBusiness Alliance. I've been on the board of directors of the BioBusiness Alliance for the last 4 years. I've found this organization to be rich in talent from an academic standpoint, from a policymaking standpoint, and from an industry standpoint. And frankly, I think this organization is best positioned in the state of Minnesota to carry forward policies in the biobusiness area. Most recently, I worked for a company called MGI Pharma. MGI Pharma was actually spun out of the University of Minnesota back in 1979 in the bioagriculture area. We actually sold to farmers some years ago. More recently, in 2000, we relocated a management team to Minnesota from the East Coast and the West Coast, from many companies like Amgen and Genentech and Immunex. We brought them here to Minnesota, where they still reside. In terms of the growth that we had, from 2003 to 2007, in our offices in Bloomington, Minnesota, we grew from 50 employees to 250. In addition to those employees, it brought other jobs to related industries, to clinical research organizations, to other scientific support organizations through this growth period. More recently, in January of 2008, MGI Pharma was acquired by a Tokyo-based company called Eisai Pharmaceuticals, which I am still employed with today. Many of my colleagues and I chose to stay in Minnesota. We're committed to Minnesota, so committed that I have to leave here very soon and get on a plane and fly to my office in New Jersey, which I don't relish. My colleagues and I
didn't understand that.
Yeah, are very committed to staying in Minnesota. And I tell you what, I'm one of the only true Minnesotans. These are transplants. But we have a passion for building other biopharmaceutical companies in Minnesota. But quite honestly, today, with the environment from a policy, a capital creation, and infrastructure standpoint, we're not as competitive as we need to be. I've had the privilege to live in Wisconsin, our close neighbor, Ohio, Kansas, and most recently in Southern California. And quite frankly, today, we are not competitive even with our close neighbor in Wisconsin. So it's my hope, through the BioBusiness Alliance, they are well positioned to be the leader organization to catalyze these policies we're talking about, to take them forward in an action-oriented way and an expeditious way where we can actually build biobusiness companies and grow jobs in Minnesota. Thank you.
And Mr. Moline, in what way are we not competitive with Wisconsin?
A couple of areas, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of areas in terms of R&D tax credits, angel investor tax credits. Those would be two I would point out where, even compared to, for example, Madison, they have pretty well-structured programs in place.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Was it this week or last week, we passed out of the Jobs and Economic Development Committee three or four pieces of legislation dealing with the investment tax credits you're talking about, including the angel investment that insurance companies that are able to a pretty good return 2-3 years down the road. So we're trying to catch up. So we know some of those issues, and Senator Tomasoni, Senator Sparks, and some other on this committee heard that legislation last week, and we're attempting to catch up. So it's on our radar, and the governor's on board. So we have great hopes in those 2 or 3 areas you're talking about.
Excellent.
But we have been behind.
Any comments or questions for the witnesses? Senator Sparks, any further comments?
Mr. Chair, just wanted to thank you, and I know that you were able to Austin see the Hormel Institute, and I think that I know we face some challenging budget times, but This committee is the Economic Development Committee, and this bill really is about jobs. We're very proud of the Hormel Institute. In fact, they're already talking about phase two of their expansion, another $50 million, another 300 jobs, and I think you heard from the other testifiers that with a little help, we can really help to stimulate the economy, and this is the industry of the future, Mr. Chair. So,
thank you, Senator Sparks. I think the governor has $200,000 for the biennium recommended here, and as everybody knows, we're in a serious budget crisis in the state. But I think one of the things we can't ignore is the potential to create jobs and get good return on your money. So while we're not exactly sure if we're going to be able to fund this just yet or how we're going to be able to fund it, we're going to keep it in consideration in the committee by laying it on the table and for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Economic Development Bill. So Senator Sparks will move that Senate File 952 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Economic Development Finance Bill. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, thank you
thank you very much.
Appreciate
Mr. Chair,
it.
Man.
Senator Fredrickson. Senator Fredrickson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. This is the second committee that this bill has been before. It was before Senator Metzen's Job and Economic Development Committee as the initial stop for it. As you all know, with the Federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, Minnesota is going to receive some $107 million of money for clean water and drinking water. To be able to use that money, we are going to need to make some changes in our programs for those two activities, and Senate File 1329 will make those changes so we can utilize that federal money. Now, Mr. Chairman, members, since this bill was in Senator Metzen's committee, Senate Counsel has looked it over again and has suggested some changes to the bill, mostly stylistic, not substantive changes. But I would like to have somebody offer that amendment. Then I would go through the changes and let you know what they are and see if you think they're appropriate.
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the amendment.
Senator Koch offers the A2 amendment. Senator Fredrickson, since this is the second committee, I would normally let you do it without explaining it, but go ahead and explain
Mr. Chairman, I fully expect and want to explain it. I'm intending to do that.
Okay, go ahead. I know it's not controversial, but just give us a quick explanation.
Mr. Chairman, as I go through this, I will point out where there are a few of the changes and also probably hit on a couple of the elements of the program. We have 120 days from February 17th to put under contract half of this money, and the rest has to be under contract within 1 year. And of that $107 million, approximately $82 million will be for clean water and approximately $25 million for drinking water. So with that as a background, I would like to walk through the amendment with you. There's one change on line 15 of the page 1, line 15. And for clarification, we added in the recipient's government unit, our entity, just to make sure that there was no ambiguity about what was intended there. And there is a change in our existing program. Normally, loans have to be repaid within 20 years. But if a municipality expense for doing these projects would exceed 1.4% of the median household income, that loan repayment would be extended out to 30 years. There's another change on line 30, just changing those to that. And again, at the top of page 2, adding in the recipient governmental unit or entity. In the middle of the page of the amendment, you'll see federal stimulus money for clean water. In the bill that was coming in here, that was for clean water and drinking water. And it was suggested by council that we divide those so that the Section 3 is for clean water and Section 4 is for drinking water. And then along with that, the original bill, the programs under clean water were in paragraphs. This bill divides them into subdivisions. And on line 16, page 2, you'll see credited to the Clean Water Revolving Fund. This is a federal money. It would be credited to the revolving fund in the initial bill that was appropriated to the Clean Water Fund. And I think it's more appropriate to say credited because it'll be appropriated out of the fund but credited to the fund. On line 23, we changed 50% to not less than 50% so that grants for more than 50% could be made in that program. And for the Clean Water Fund, grants are made on an as-bid basis in the order in which they are received, and that is the order received by the Pollution Control Agency for the Clean Water Fund. And again, down on, further on page 3, we're changing appropriated to credited. At the bottom of page 3, not less than from 50% to not less than 50%. And then in the clean drinking water, those projects are certified by the Department of Health because that is for drinking water, and the Department of Health is the agency that does that. And, Mr. Chairman, I believe that is the sum of the changes that were made in this amendment. If there are questions about any of it, I'd be glad to respond.
Was there a 20% thing or something that you talked to me about?
Mr. Chairman, we'll talk about that a little later. In the Clean Water Fund, they're allowed up to they're given a 5% grant, and in the drinking water, it's a 10% grant. But I thought we would do this pretty much non-substantive changes then.
Okay.
Have that discussion after Mr. Coleman gives more details of the bill.
Okay, are there any questions on the E2 amendment? Senator Dibble.
I can ask after we adopt the amendment.
Okay. Seeing none, Senator Polk moves that the A2 amendment now be adopted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those motion adopted. Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious about, we don't really expect there won't be sufficient applications, do we? I mean, I'm looking at, you know, the green infrastructure subdivision for the clean water and for the drinking water thing. If they're insufficient, then they're going to be used for green infrastructure or energy efficiencies.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I'd like to have Mr. Coleman respond to that, and perhaps he could walk through the details of the bill that I went over rather quickly.
My real question, Mr. Chair, is if there are insufficient, and you can just get to it whenever you get to it, but if you, you know, preview my question is, there are insufficient applications, which I can't imagine, then how are we going to figure out the green infrastructure, the energy efficiency piece?
Got that, Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, the reason the language is in there is that we duplicated the language in the federal law, which requires 20% of the money to be set aside for a variety of things that we kind of lump under as green infrastructure. And then they spell out what the state needs to do to accomplish that, one, address, do projects that are on the project priority list, but also do a request for proposals, solicit projects, and they waive us having to do it in priority order and want us to fund those projects on a ready-to-construct basis. So that's the reason language is in there. And then if for some reason there are insufficient applications, we're going to do our best not be in that case, mm-hmm. We can put the money back into the fund so we don't lose it at the end of 12 months. And that's allowed under the federal law. I agree with you. I don't think we're going to have any shortage of projects.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe to Senator Dibble's question, are we going to get down farther than 35 on the list then, 35 points? Or?
Mr. Chair, when it comes to the green infrastructure, we're going to open it wide up on a first-served basis as the projects are ready to bid. We're going to look at the projects on the current list, go down to 35 that are ready to go, ready to bid. And with the request for proposal. As long as you're eligible under the Clean Water Revolving, they're ready to bid. We're going to fund them. That's kind of the intent of the legislation. We will go below the 35 points to deal with that aspect of the fund.
Are there any projects that are on the list that would not be utilizing the latest technology and not be considered green?
Mr. Chair, yes, quite a few of them. There's probably only a handful that would qualify as green technology, whether capturing methane gas and using that as cogeneration, electricity, things like that. Historically, a lot of those activities, when it's costed out, it's kind of a no benefit. I mean, the savings over the life of the facility equal the cost, so to speak. So rather than having take the gamble of new technology failing and not knowing what some of the unknowns and having to train operators to operate and maintain it, they've tend to ignore that. So I'm hope that element that can be built into a lot of these things. I'm hoping that 25% grant on the green technology will motivate a lot more of those type of additions to wastewater treatment.
Well, Mr. Coleman, isn't just the fact that they're doing things like cleaning up mercury and phosphorus and stuff like that, doesn't that make them green right there, or is it?
That's, Madam or Mr. Chair, committee members, not in the definition of in the laws. Designed to clean water, but the green infrastructure is to do a variety of things. It's really conserve energy, co-generate energy, things like that. They talk about, you know, grass on the roofs of treatment plants, water retention and treatment that is keeping the ground or keeping the water locally and allowing it to go into the ground rather than putting it into a pipe and running it down a river, a variety of things like that. So it's kind of an additional component over and above the traditional cleaning up the clean water, so to speak. But it needs to be clean water.
So how is your agency handling this then? Are you contacting the people who have already applied and who have already qualified for money that you could get some more if you add a little bit of green element to your thing, or are they supposed to just know this and make an application, or how's this?
As soon as this bill passes, Mr. Chair, we will go out on a request for proposal. We've tried to let everybody know that this is available. As far as existing projects on the list, ready to go to have these components, I mean, they'll be ready to go. And then it's just a matter of soliciting more.
Okay.
I should also mention this is an element that's currently in the House bill and permanent change to the fund, along 20% green technology. So we expect it to be a permanent component.
And so is that the entire $107 million of money that Senator Fredrickson is talking about? Is that all green technology money?
No, Mr. Chair, we're required to spend 20%
okay.
funds on green
That's
technology.
That's what that 20%
is. We're proposing a 25% grant for that. Okay. The rest of it is going to be spent on a first-come, first-served basis. As soon as they bid, we'll provide the grant and loan combinations based on the statutory authority provided in this bill. And when that money runs out, we'll use the traditional sources of funds that we have or blend them. I don't think anybody's going to get 100% stimulus money. They'll get, you know, our bond proceeds and, as well as the stimulus fund
okay.
combination.
What do you need to add to what Senator Fredrickson has already said?
Not a whole lot. This is a good thing. We've got lots of money to spend. We want to do it real quickly. We do have one more amendment that changes the policy a little bit because we have a base grant of 5% and clean water and a base grant of 10% on the drinking water, and we're finding that really with the projects that are being bid and let now that the Buy American clause is costing more than we anticipated. Given your world economy, a lot of components and parts are being built in other countries, and suppliers and manufacturers are very limited, and prices tend to accelerate. So we're looking at increasing the grant amount to 20% in both programs to cover those We initially took did 5% simply because we thought the reporting requirements were going to be sufficient. We wanted to provide some incentives for communities to use the stimulus money. And the 5% was trying to cover reporting requirements. But this will cover that plus provide a good incentive to move forward.
Mm-hmm. To the Toledo.
Okay, yeah. Then Senator Koch will move the 8-3 amendment to the delete all amendment. Are there any questions or comments about this? Essentially, we're moving the grant money up from 5% to 20%, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Seeing no questions, all of the favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Okay. Any further comments on this bill, Senator Fredrickson? Okay. And this bill, we're actually going to try and move out of here because we want to get this thing moving. And so Senator Koch will move that Senate file 1329, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Fredrickson and Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much.
Senator Bonner. Senator Bonhoeff, have you been before this committee before?
Mr. Chair, I have not.
I didn't think so.
Do you know the rule?
You know the rule, don't you? There's a long-standing rule in this committee that on your first bill, you're required to buy a drink for everybody on the committee next time you say
that. Standing and never collect.
On the record, Mr. Chair. Well, it's nice to be before this committee.
Nice
thank
to have
you very
you.
Much.
Senator Saxon.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that's only if she wants it passed.
Yeah. I forgot to put that in there. That's a good point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog, now I know what I was missing. So, Mr. Chair, I have before you Senate File 1198, which is an agency bill. And before I talk about that, I do have an amendment. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment.
We have the A1 amendment.
And this amendment is technical in nature. It just matches up to what got passed in the House yesterday so that it goes through the process in the smoothest way.
And you want me to believe that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but I will let Mr. Nelson as he and Mr. Hamilton, as they talk about the bill, they can review the technical changes.
Okay. All right. Senator Sparks will move the A1 amendment, and we'll add this amendment after we do a little bit of discussion on the bill. And if you guys can basically let us know when you're talking about something where the amendment has made a change, that would be helpful. Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned, it is a policy and housekeeping bill brought forward by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The bill is in four articles. Article 1 is deed policy and includes several small policy issues. As people are aware, the big change that was made this session was in Senator Metzen's bill that we have already passed early in the session. So Article 2 is deed housekeeping, and Chuck Hamilton will describe these sections. Articles 3 and 4 are the product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. That council is made up of legislators, business, labor groups, including the State Chamber of Commerce, National Federation of Independent Businesses, Mechanical Contractors Association, the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters Legal Advocacy, and the Temporary Staffing Association. And I do serve on that commission, and I can tell you that the members of that commission have worked on this bill that you have before you. So these articles do have minor policy changes and housekeeping changes, and I will let, and Lee Nelson will describe those sections, and so I'll begin by turning it over to Mr. Hamilton.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hamilton. Say your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Hamilton. I'm the Director of State Services for the Blind, as well as a member of the DEED legislative team, and it's in that latter capacity that I come before you today First, regarding the amendment that's before the committee, none of the pieces of the amendment have to do with Articles 1 and 2, which I'll be going through. So, okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Article 1 has to do with deed policy changes. There are basically four changes. The first change is in Sections 1 and 2. Members will recognize that language in that that is the substance of Senate File 684, which has passed the Senate, related to the Bioscience Business Development Infrastructure Grant Program. It extended the definition to include higher education. At some point, as we see things progressing in the House, I suspect that that will no longer be part of this particular bill. Mr. Chairman, Sections 3 and 4 on pages 2 and 3 have to do with the Minnesota Investment Fund. It expands the authorized use of the Minnesota Investment Fund to provide more investment in renewable or green, clean energy market development. It would allow low-interest loans for renewable energy equipment manufacturing, training grants to support renewable energy workforce, and allow external marketing to garner more national and international investment in Minnesota's renewable sector. Mr. Chair and members, Section 5 has to do with state services for the blind. This section has clarifies the relationship between individual blind vendors' employees and the state of Minnesota. We've been advised by staff that we need to clarify that relationship and make it clear that the state is not responsible for the workers' compensation coverage of blind vendors' employees. Blind vendors are independent contractors. They are under law, rule, and contract, separate entities, but we've been advised to make this change and are doing so.
How was this handled before we were about to make this change?
Mr. Chairman, this has never come up before in the 70 years of this particular program. It goes back to 1938. It's always been assumed, but a situation has arisen where we've been advised to clarify what we already believe to be the case.
Was there a claim? Is that?
There is a claim.
Okay, and you believe that that should not be a valid claim? Is that what?
It is the position of the state that that's not a valid claim. However, we do anticipate that this change in law will probably not have impact on that claim.
Okay. And are the people who are the advocates for the blind, are they okay with this?
The Blind Vendors Elected Committee, who blind vendors elect to represent them in relationships with the agency, are aware of and support this.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the last policy piece in Article 1 relates to vocational rehabilitation. There are a number of changes within that small section on page 4. Most of those are stylistic changes done by the revisor's office. However, the substance really is to strike the plan and budget requirement and rather request audited financial statements of the prior year. It gives us better information, and there is no disagreement about that. Mr. Chairman, members, as we said, there are small policy changes, and that is those. Article 2 has to do with housekeeping. As most of you know, deed has been bolted together over the years with multiple chapters, some addressing, frankly, similar issues. Most recently, the Department of Economic Security and the Department of Trade and Economic Development merged to form the Department of Employment and Economic Development some 5 years ago. Commissioner McElroy asked us to go through the statutes, including other departments' chapters, where reference to deed appears, and update where appropriate. We have cleared those changes with other departments where necessary. There are some common themes among these 19 or so provisions. A number of them have to do with correcting the department name. A number have to do with changing the name Workforce Investment Act, the Workforce Investment Act, from the former name Job Training Partnership Act. Another group have to do with removing startup or transition language to boards or programs. And finally, probably the most interesting and taking the most number of pages, but frankly doing absolutely nothing except consolidating various statutes, has to do with the commissioner's duties and the financial activities of the department. those particular changes, again taking up the most space, do not increase nor decrease the commissioner's duties or responsibilities, and frankly, require us to make a number of changes in repealers, which are at the end of this article. Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to go through each and one, every one of those, or I can respond to questions either way.
Can the commissioner get more gifts than we can?
Mr. Chair, members.
That would be one.
That would be one.
I think not.
I was wondering what that one is right there, section four on page six.
Mr. Chairman?
Uh-huh.
If I might, what sets like the department a little differently related to gifts actually comes within state services for the blind. We have a history of, frankly, soliciting gifts since 1953 when the Ham family of Ham's Beer started to participate in making more reading material available for blind and visually impaired people in Minnesota. It's been a long, a rewarding relationship, probably the first private-public partnership before we actually coined that term.
So all this new language is?
From elsewhere in the statutes, Mr. Chairman.
And so it's just being recodified? Or?
No,
correct.
No.
We worked very closely with the revisor's office on this. And it's basically taking from here, putting here, getting rid of that. In one case, for example, I believe it's section 19, we're actually leaving a portion of one thing and instructing the revisor to put it part in another part that we're where we're putting the rest of a lot of other things. It's trying to put things in one place so we don't have multiple places for duties, for fiscal things, that kind of thing. But we have not increased nor decreased the duties of the commissioner nor the fiscal issues related to the operation of the department.
And there's no substantive changes?
Not to my knowledge, no, sir.
Okay. All right. Does anybody want Mr. Hamilton to discuss or explain any of the changes that he just talked about in Article 2? Okay. Is that
well, Mr. Chair, if he could just state what the repealers are. What do they represent?
The repealers on page 23.
Be happy
yeah.
To, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that. Okay. 116J.402, as well as the next one, 0.413, are the repealers related to consolidating the commissioner's duties. 116J.58, subdivision 1, has to do with section 5 of the bill, where we're combining that again with the commissioner's duties. 116J.59 is a standalone repealer, and what it does is removes language that allows the department to have a petty cash fund. Our fiscal officer said there is other state law, 15.191, that already allows us to do that, and we don't need to have duplicative department statute to do the same thing.
And that's called an impressed fund?
Impressed, correct. But more commonly known as petty cash.
As opposed to unimpressed? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members, 116J.61 also relates to Section 5 of the bill, where we are moving more powers and duties into 401, 116J.401, and therefore repealing where some of them came from. 116J.656 is a standalone. I use that. It's unrelated to other parts. This is a statute we're repealing because the 2008 legislature actually replaced this with 116J.657 and added a small piece, which I'm blocking on at this moment. But anyway, it's unnecessary language because you've already updated it. 116L.16 is a standalone. This is related to the Job Skills Partnership Distance Work Grants. This is something that's been in the statutes for at least 10 years for the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. It's never been used. There is no interest by anyone to do it, and they've asked it to be removed. 116L.88, local service plans. This relates to Section 16 of Article 2. This, the local service plans are something that the department used to do in relationship to the Department of Human Services. In 2004, the department was no longer involved in that, and that was replaced by human services statutes of their own, 256J.626, subdivision 4F. So we need to remove it from their statute, and we need to remove as well here in a repeal from our own statute, because we don't do this anymore and have not done so since 2004. 116U.65 has to do with the Office of Tourism. This is transition language, part of which I talked about up front, when they were moved out of the department. And Madam, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that ends the repealer section for Article 2.
Okay. Senator Kubley?
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions of those two articles? Okay. Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll now turn it over to Mr. Nelson to talk about the unemployment insurance policy.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. As Senator Bonoff indicated, the Article 3 and Article 4 are a product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. Committee would specifically ask me to go through each section. I'd just like to highlight two particular sections in Article 1, which I believe make a real substantive change. The others are extremely minor policy matters. I would like to highlight Section 12 on page 32. That requires an employer who is filing an appeal by an agent, a paid agent, meaning an attorney or an accountant or a third-party processor. There is a few large companies, national companies, which process matters, unemployment insurance matters for employers, and they file appeals on behalf of an employer. This would say if they are filing an appeal on behalf of an employer, that they have to do it online. We believe this will save two staff positions. Literally by seeing employers do it online. Again, these people are being paid to do this on behalf of an employer. If they do file it online, they can literally schedule the hearing right there. They can pick their day, pick their time, and get the hearing scheduled, all automatic. The department doesn't have to do anything in regards to that appeal. As I say, we believe this will save a lot of staff positions. And it is the way the court system is going, especially on a federal level, requiring people to do things online. The next thing I would like to highlight is
Mr. Nelson, when you say when you say save two staff positions, is that with somebody you would have to hire, or is it two people you'd get rid of?
I should say we could reassign them to what I would call value-added work, rather than just typing in names and addresses and picking a day for them. That would all be done. We could actually assign those staff people to value-added work, which I would call paying benefits on a timely basis.
Okay.
The most valued work we do.
That's good. Okay.
So highlight Section 14 on page 33. This does put a new penalty on employers. We currently request employers to provide a weekly breakdown of wages paid to particular people. It's the only way we can detect fraud. The example is an individual who works for an employer. He's laid off, collects unemployment benefits for a period of time, and then goes to work for a new employer. Sometimes they don't report to us that they are working and continue to collect benefits. To determine whether they committed fraud, we need to find a weekly breakdown. How much did they work in a particular week, and how much did they earn? We send out notices to the employer. In 2008, we sent 60,000 of these notices. Over 20,000 were not returned. As we find that especially some of the big service companies, this takes a little work for them to fill out this information. They just throw it in the wastebasket. We don't receive the information. We can't detect fraud. The Advisory Council's way of getting employers to comply is simply say, okay, there'll be a $100 penalty if you don't return this information. Representative Gunther, very adamant, we put in there, very clear that we have to provide that there will be a penalty on the employer. On the notice, it has to state very clearly there is this penalty if you don't return this information. As I say, this is the only way you can detect fraud, absent sending an auditor on site to actually gather the information. And over 20,000 of these notices are not returned each year. We believe this will bring substantial compliance to these requests for information. Those are the two particular, well, I'd like to highlight a third section in Article 1, which is Section 15 on page 34. The department has obtained a grant from the United States Department of Labor to help dislocated workers start their own business. But the unemployment insurance statute would not allow unemployment benefits to be paid while these people are attempting to start their own business and getting assistance through the dislocated worker program. This would allow us to provide unemployment benefits to those individuals who are working through the small business centers in an attempt to start up their own business. Now, the grant is limited to 500 people, and they have to be 50 years of age or older. So it's a very limited pilot project. Employer groups fully endorse this, and it's essentially one of the only ways we can get a success of this federal grant, which we've already obtained for over $2.5 million. So they say it's a small program, which we believe is a very good idea in helping individuals get back to work. It may be the best way for a particular individual to get back to work is to start his own business. I'd like to highlight just a couple of things in Article 4, which are technical changes.
Before you go to Article 4, could you just give me a quick overview of on page 23 and page 24, there's a whole bunch of languages crossed out. Can you just kind of quickly tell me what that is?
On 23 and 24, currently a state or a political subdivision as well as a nonprofit have the option of how they wish to meet their unemployment insurance obligations. They can choose to pay taxes the same as all for-profit businesses, or they can do what's called reimburse the trust fund, which is simply we send them a monthly bill and they pay it for the unemployment insurance costs. Now, if they want to switch between methods, currently there are a number of restrictions. We're asking that some of those restrictions be moved. I was the initiator of, quite frankly, these current restrictions because of the concern that employers would abuse it. We've never had an instance of abuse in 15 years. I think these restrictions, which make it fairly complex to determine whether they do or don't move between methods, is simply these are administrative hurdles which needn't be there. As I said, we've never had a problem of an employer attempting to abuse between methods, and this simply streamlines the process. We have never had an instance where a state or a governmental entity has opted to choose between methods, but federal law requires that they have that option. We do get nonprofits who do choose to become taxpaying or switch between methods. I can go into a long explanation of why they do that, but there are reasons why they would want to have a different method. But we have never seen an abuse, therefore we don't need to have restrictions on it, which just, quite frankly, make it cumbersome to determine allowing them to switch between methods. So that's all this is doing, is streamlining a process between switching between tax paying and reimbursing and vice versa.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. You had asked Mr. Nelson as he went through the bill to refer to the amendment when we're at those sections, and I know we have gone through some of those pages already. If you would like to have that, or would you prefer to do it at the end, Mr. Nelson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the amendment, what it does, it removes some language which, as you can see, Section 11 on page 31, it deletes that because that is in Senator Tomasoni's stimulus bill. So it is removing some language which was in here. This bill was drafted a long time before the stimulus was even passed on the federal level. So this removes any of the conflicting language and makes it line up. We were asked by an advocacy group to remove the word available. It's an unnecessary word in four different places. We agree with that. I think it just simply complicates things and makes it confusing and conflicting. So that word was removed. On page 62, it allows the department to recoup an overpayment in any method allowed under state or federal law. As you'll see on page 63, they have been drafted as to fraud overpayments, and this would simply allow any overpayment to be collected as allowed under state or federal law. So it kind of jumps the gun in case federal law may change. We don't have a provision where Minnesota law wouldn't allow it, but federal law would, and we get into all that federal law trumping state law. So it simply makes it a little clearer and easier regarding recouping of an overpayment. The only parts of Article 4 I would like to...
Well, after that explanation, then Senator Sparks moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. Okay.
The only thing I would like to highlight in Article 4 is on page 12, which is Section 12. The United States Department of Labor held Clause 3 out of federal conformity. And under the commissioner's authority in 268.23, this particular provision has no force in effect. So it is no longer effective law in Minnesota and hasn't been for over a year. So therefore, we're simply asking it to be removed from the statute. As I say, Department of Labor ruled it out of conformity. I would also like to highlight pages 50, 51, and page 50 and 51, which, while it appears to be new language, this was how the reviser decided to have this drafted. When I originally had drafted it up and gave it to the reviser, I did an underline and strikeout, and simply removing some obsolete provisions regarding a continued request. The reviser said we did so many strikeouts that they should simply repeal the whole section of 268.06 and just reprint it as 268.065. So that's what it does. It simply removes a lot of obsolete particular things regarding a continued request, which hadn't been enforced in effect or hadn't been used in over 15 years. So simply removing a lot of obsolete language. Those are the things I'd like to bring to the committee's attention and can answer any questions that you might have on any other
provision. Is that on page 50 and 51?
Yes, on page 50 and 51.
And this looks like new language in this bill. So where is it removing obsolete language from?
Well, as Mr. Chairman indicated, the reviser had decided to repeal 268.086 and just reprint it because it had so many strikeouts and each particular subdivision of 086.
I got you.
That
so
this is just reprinted. Straight.
Okay, I got it. All right. Okay. You didn't leave anything controversial, right? No. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think anything in the bill is controversial.
Okay. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, you know, I guess I have one, you know, why is it that, a business owner who owns, 1% of a small business and doesn't have a parent or a child who owns up to 25%, they have to pay unemployment insurance premiums for themselves, but they aren't allowed to collect a benefit if the business has to close for a short time. It doesn't seem fair to me to collect the premium if we're not going to offer coverage to that person.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, last year, I believe it was in this committee, Senator Vandiver offered an amendment which quite an expansion and dealt with business owners. There is no prohibition against an individual who's a business owner who would own 1% from collecting unemployment benefits. I'd heard about a particular instance involving a particular constituent of yours, and if that is in fact what happened, that was wrong. There is no legal authority to deny benefits to an individual who's a business owner of 1%. That is, there is nothing in the law that would do that. If the department is incorrect, I'd like to know the name of that particular constituent, and I'll have it fixed.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, I think I should probably provide you with that information just so that, or at least so that they could talk to you. I think that would be beneficial, too.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, I will certainly speak with that individual. And as I say, if the department was incorrect, I will have it fixed.
Mr. Chair, as I look at the bill we're looking at right now, I see that the amendment does not match your bill, Senate File 1197. Some aspects of the amendment.
Mr. Nelson is go ahead,
Chairman,
and try and explain this.
Like to speak with staff. What we are attempting to do is so that each bill would mesh. There wouldn't be any conflicting language in each bill, but they could mesh. We're still dealing with a particular section, but they're handled differently, so the reviser could easily mesh them together. Worked quite a bit with Craig Gustafson, who was in the reviser's office for 12 years, in making sure that they mesh together. So there will be a particular section which is in this bill, which is in Senate File 1197, but there's no conflict between the two sections after the amendment is put on.
Okay, well, if that's the intent, and if that's not how the amendment...
Mr. Nelson, in specific, we're talking about the section that deals with available for suitable employment defined. Is that the section that you're speaking of when you say that there's a section that is that you're still looking at?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Doyle, could we speak about that as a sidebar? I mean, it may be I'd like to see exactly that. But the intent is so that they would match up.
I have to call you guys in chamber here?
Judge.
No, we'll figure it out. I think I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to make my bill not be repetitive in Senator Bonhoff's bill, correct?
Mr. Chairman, more so they don't conflict, so that there's no particular provision which conflicts, that they would simply mesh. They both may deal with a particular same section, but they will simply mesh together without any words being in conflict,
okay,
or any particular clauses or sections or paragraphs being in conflict.
This bill, I think we're going to lay it over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. And so when we do my bill and it passes out of here, we'll have time to make sure that we get it right.
Or we can do it in conference.
Well, we can do it whatever it takes, but we'll figure it out, okay? Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, we were wondering if it would be possible to work out some of these questions with the hopes that actually the bill could travel separately. Given its non-controversial and housekeeping and technical in nature, the department, I believe, wants to make sure this gets done. So I wondered if we could meet with council, make sure that we're doing it properly.
Yeah,
and then
we'll keep it here for now, and then
very good.
Yeah, and then we'll see what happens after this. Okay, and then we'll get it right.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
All right. Does anybody else have any questions or comments,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Jensen.
On page 3, there's a kind of a change in the financial leveraging of projects. If you look on line 3.14. One half the cost, which is usually the match, and then on line 3.21 and 3.22, that match goes away for renewable energy projects. So they could get 100% of the cost up to $1 million for their project. And currently it's a match or up to 50%. So that is a change. You lose the leverage of the money that's in the fund.
Okay. So we got a financial implication too.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
I wonder if there was any questions with regard to suitable employment. I know we spent a long time working on that on the uninsurance commission. And so I wondered if there was a question that was raised.
I guess I don't know. Does anybody know about that?
Okay. No, thanks.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, Senator Sparks then moves that Senate File 1198 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Economic Development and Housing Budget. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, thank you all very much. Appreciate your time. Senator Olson, are you ready or you are? Okay, all right. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to be having the opportunity to once again carry the OIC bill at Senate File 1057. The Minnesota Opportunities Industrialization Centers, which are known commonly as OICs, have been operating in Minnesota since 1967. They've been very successful in stimulating economic development and workforce development in my area. They were very successfully worked with the Leech Lake Tribe in training people who were needed to work as nurse practitioners. They put people to work and filled a need in the community. And there are many, many other examples of very targeted and successful work that they've been able to do with a small amount of funding that they've had from the state. The OICs are funded with a combination of private, federal, and state dollars. Traditionally, about 27% of their funding has come from the state. Well, and that was the percentage in the 07-08 budget. The way that they're budgeted, because they're not part of the general fund, they have to come back for their funding repeatedly, and or in every budgeting cycle and request funding. They are in the governor's budget for the 10-11 budget at $2.5 million, but that would be a reduction of $250,000 from the previous biennium's funding. They would really appreciate keeping their budget whole, keeping the ability to stimulate job growth and economic development, especially in this this time where economic stimulus of this type is really needed. And so with that, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Dr. Lee Antel.
Dr. Antel, welcome to the committee, and please say your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Lee Antel. I'm the president and CEO of the American Indian OIC. The OIC motto is providing opportunity and changing lives, and that's what we do for thousands of Minnesota's poorest citizens. We take the poorest citizens, the least educated, the least job trained, and prepare them for employment. And throughout our program, which is five affiliates, we have OICs in five places within Minnesota. We serve literally hundreds of people on an annual basis. Perhaps by an anecdote, I can share you the spirit and heart of what the American Indian OICs are all about. Our founder was a Baptist minister by the name of Dr. Leon Sullivan. He was a huge man, a Baptist preacher, and he was very prominent throughout the 60s. And he used to say this when he'd have a gathering of this nature or a church or corporate leaders and so forth. He used to say, I know I will get my milk and honey in heaven, but I need my ham and eggs here on earth. And so that's what the OICs are. We are the ham and eggs providers.
Smart man.
If you take all of the places where a person might go to school in Minnesota, from the university system to the state colleges and private colleges, there's a lot of places can go, but not for the population we serve. They need a special niche. They need a special place where people understand them, people care about them, people are culturally sensitive. And we've had this ongoing service since 1967. I think if you would talk to other people who fund us, like the city of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, the state of Minnesota foundations, that we do have a good track record. And we would be pleased to answer any questions that you may have. I know time is running short. We do have another speaker.
Mr. Chair,
welcome,
I have
welcome
one
to
more
the
speaker.
Committee. Please say your name for the record.
My name is Linda White. I am the chair of the Minnesota OIC State Council. And of course, we are the umbrella organization for the five OICs that operate in Minnesota. I have been a volunteer with the OIC centers for some 30 plus years, starting out as a young banker at First Bank St. Paul, now U.S. Bank. And continuing up to this point, primarily because I feel that the OICs are very cost-effective, have a dedicated group of leaders to guide them in a strategic way, and that we have seen and been able to deliver on results. For example, the last fiscal year, we serve 2,449 unemployed or underemployed clients. The comprehensive training we offer includes the CNA, Certified Nursing Assistant, ABE, Adult Basic Education, Basic Computer Operations, Electronic Manufacturing, and also American Indian OIC has their School of Business. In addition, we have special projects. Recognizing the number of immigrants that have come to Minnesota and their specialized needs and training, we have responded in that regard. In addition, we have restorative justice programs and help individuals who have been incarcerated become citizens once again in their communities. A new area of ours is the 100 Summit Academy's 100 Hard Hats program, along with Anishinaabe OIC for the building trades. Recognizing that the construction trade areas, especially in view of some of the stimulus money coming down for green jobs, et cetera, these are high demand, high wage positions in which the citizens that we serve and train can support their families and not become a burden on the state. So we constantly look at our programs and reevaluate what is happening in the economy, the demand, and we help with the supply. Our council was incorporated in 1983, and we have continued our mission of serving individuals and providing quality education, training, and employment services. We are a network of organizations nationally across the United States. We learn from each other and from the states that they represent what is current in their states as well. But we do serve a common goal, and that is training individuals and helping individuals become better citizens. Our statistics are varied in terms of the diversity that we represent, and also our participants. There are 89% minorities, as an example. Dr. Antel talked about the challenge individuals that we serve. 89% of those are minorities. 38% are welfare recipients. We are happy to report that for every dollar that is invested by the legislature, that our return on investment is approximately $20 for everyone. So first of all, I want to stop a minute and thank you. Thank you, Dr. Senator Tomasoni and your committee and the legislature for supporting the OIC centers, our work, and what we do to help the citizens of Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That was very nice. Appreciate that. You want to say something, sir?
Pierre Nyberg, American Indian OIC. Just 3 points. We also had a American Indian OIC had the low-income deed grant.
Sir, can you say your name for the record, please?
Pierre Nyberg.
Pierre Nyberg. Thank you. Welcome.
We were recommended to reapply, and we just finished the final report and met all the goals of our low-income worker. Even though the economy got, as you know, pretty rough in 2008, we still met all the goals of the deed grant, and we're very proud of that. A couple more things that I think we do really well as, in the old terminology, we take people off welfare and we put them to work. So it's a double savings for the state. The next thing we do is we prevent and help prisoners coming out of prison get reemployed so they don't reoffend and go back. And I think right now we prevent at least 90 guys from going back and reoffending by helping them. Thank you.
90 out of how many?
I mean, how many don't succeed?
Yeah. Well, how many have you tried with and haven't?
I think we see at least 200 ex-offenders a year.
Really?
And a lot of them are, as you know, under the gun with their PO. They have to get a job within 30 days, get housing, get going. We do the best we can. If they have the attitude, if they want to learn, if they want to get a job, we can help them.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the top of your back page where it says outcomes, and I see that you've enrolled 1,524 clients and 833 managed to complete. That doesn't seem like a great outcome to me. Just wondering if you can add more to that, conditions, et cetera.
Well, the easiest explanation, it's not an excuse, is the folks that we serve have multiple barriers to employment and succeeding. Actually, the highest barrier for most people to come to AIOIC is they don't have any money. And what's left over when they can leverage a Pell and a straight camp is very little to live on. So instead of calling them dropouts, I call them stopouts. But actually, not to be too competitive, I think our graduation rate is actually better than the University of Minnesota's.
Oops.
Sorry.
That's a nice try. Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Is your tuition cheaper?
Yes. Actually, to tell you the funny story, when we did the EMT, you know, emergency medical tech, a lot of people who would have taken it at the U took it from us because we were quite a few hundred dollars cheaper.
Interesting. Was the training better, too?
It's the same test, same exam. National exam.
Okay. All right, any other questions or comments? Senator Olson, any last comments?
No, I don't have anything further, Mr. Chair, other than to say again how successful I know this program has been in my area. It was just really fun to go to a graduation ceremony that the OIC had for some of the young people who were, young men and women, mostly women, I think, who graduated from the nurse practitioner program. And these were young ladies who probably without that intervention would not have gone on for any additional training and more than likely would not have been employed. And they were really proud. Many of them were the first people in their family to be graduating from that type of, any type of program that kind of, where they would have some kind of profession. And they were not only these young ladies, but their families were very proud of the work that they'd accomplished.
It looks like the governor has
as recommended, about 2.5 million over the biennium. Yours looks like it about 2.7. So we're close, I guess. And you do certainly serve an interesting population, that's for sure, and have a very good return on the dollar. So we will see what we can do and figure out how to get this into the budget. And if nobody else has any questions, then Senator Olson moves that Senate File 1057 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus economic development and housing bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion to adopt. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee.
Chairman,
Senator Tomasoni.
Member, Senate File 1197 is conforming Minnesota law to the requirements necessary to receive the federal stimulus funds for the unemployment compensation. And this is one of the bills that we want to move out of here quickly because of the fact that we will receive the federal money quicker. And the quicker we receive the money, the sooner we start making receiving interest on it. Also, the department has calculated that out of the $130 million that we'll be receiving from the federal stimulus money, we will be making about $400,000 a month in interest into the unemployment fund. And so the legislation before you basically does what needs to be done in order to get the money. There were three different ways to do it. Minnesota chose the cheapest way to do it and save the most money, and I think it was probably the smartest way to do it. In our last committee, Senator Shy had some concerns about some of the language on page 10, and so if we could pass out the 8-4 amendment to take care of those concerns. I don't think that it's a controversial amendment. If anybody needs to have it explained, I can have Mr. Nelson actually say what Senator Scheid's concerns were and why we made the changes.
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the program. The Veterans Committee, Senator Scheid, expressed some concerns about 10 lines 31 33. She just felt that language was very confusing. Indicated in committee that we would certainly work with her to address her concerns. We met with her, and she indicated the language in the amendment addresses her concerns. She thinks it clarifies what the intent of the paragraph was. It doesn't change the intent of the paragraph in any way, but simply clarifies and makes very clear exactly what the paragraph was intended to do.
So, Mr. Chairman, if somebody has any questions on that amendment, I'll move the A4 amendment.
On Senator Tomasoni's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The A4 amendment is adopted. And Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I if Mr. Nelson would like to add anything else that I haven't said about the bill, and maybe he should give you some technical jargon here so you know exactly what's going on.
Okay. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill, Senator Tomasoni indicated the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, if this legislation passes, will receive $30.1 million into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. As this committee is aware, that trust fund is not in. Once it goes into deficit in about Christmas, currently, this legislation, it will go into deficit somewhere in December. then once it does go into deficit, it will stay in deficit for a number of years. This will help that. Basically, it will forestall deficit status by a little over a month or about a month. As the senator indicated, what happens if the trust fund has positive balance, it earns interest because it's on deposit in the federal treasury. It earns interest at 4% currently. So each month or each week that money is on deposit, it earns $100,000. The sooner this bill passed, the sooner we could apply for that stimulus money. $100,000 per week. So that's the answer quickly if possible. I can answer any questions regarding the technical provisions. I've spoken with the United States Department of Labor. The bill will meet the requirements. Some of the changes necessary are in particular. Department of Labor is very concerned about every I being dotted and every T being crossed. In this language, they have seen, and they agree, will meet the federal requirements. I should say, according to the, there's a fiscal note, it will increase benefit payouts about, we estimate, $1 million to $1.5 million per year. To individuals. No person is adversely impacted at all, but will provide additional benefits to a few hundred people. But for that, Minnesota will receive $130 million.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Certainly seems to me that it would make sense, Senator Tomassoni, that we move this along as quickly as possible. But
no questions or comments, Mr. Chairman, and I'll move that Senate File 1197 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Further discussion? On the Tomassoni motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed and sent to Finance. Mr. O'Rourke.
Mr. Chair, members, we are hearing more bills next week. And we are coming up where we're going to start probably putting together and getting some, as the both policy deadlines and the looming third deadline coupled with the scheduled break are coming up. I think we've got one hearing right before third deadline. So we're going to be in the next 2 weeks probably start seeing some assembly of budgets. That'll start happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
With that, meeting adjourned.